This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 12th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking, what makes a good children's book? Does it need wizards and dragons? Do the words or the pictures come first? How do you write a book designed to be read aloud? Should there always be a moral to the tale? And do you have to be a teacher as well as an author? And most importantly, how do you capture a child's imagination? We'll meet a Canadian author who's introducing a South Korean folklore to young readers. We'll head to the studio of an illustrator to find out how you draw for a child. And we'll speak to a children's book expert, Dawn Books here in London, to take the temperature of the children's book publishing industry.
I think children like that possibility of being left alone without their parents and to have their own adventure, and that's what really appeals.
That's all to come as we find out what makes a good children's book on this week's edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're going to begin in Marylebone, just around the corner from Monocle HQ at Daunt Books. The independent bookseller has a reputation for stocking the highest quality authors, the most beautifully designed books, and for their knowledgeable staff. So where better to discuss the state of children's publishing? Culture producer Holly popped into Daunt Books to speak to Yonah Dudley, one of the shop's booksellers who specialises in children's books, to discuss the authors, illustrators and publishers who are leading the way.
Yeah, clever and inventive and fantastic reviews. So
we speak to lots of different children's publishers and they come and show us their stock, and usually we try and go for slightly more interesting books than maybe more mainstream booksellers. We like things with really good design, good stories. We prefer things that are classic, and there are lots of publishers who are either doing reissues or using a similar style of illustration, so they're much more classic, kind of, they look almost like a 50s illustration, which we prefer and we find that our customers really like as well.
What is it about these older stories that you think draws your customers in?
I think there's a nostalgia for their own childhood, so they like things that often, books that they remember from their childhood that have been reissued, or even similar illustrations. So there are lots of reissues of Ladybird books, and also the Moomins have become much more popular again, and I think it is that classic design that people find, and they want to hand over things that they enjoyed as a child to their own children.
And what about newer stories? What sort of things do you look for in those?
Those cases we usually just want something that's either very fun or very interesting. So we've been doing a lot with a publisher called Flying Eye. They have a book called Shackleton's Journey, which is this beautifully illustrated by William Grill. And it's a beautifully illustrated book about the history of the Antarctic and of Ernest Shackleton's journeys there. And obviously that's much more obscure a story than you would maybe expect a young child to be interested in, but we found that they've loved them, the parents love them, and it's just doing offering something that's a lot different to kind of your usual Beast Quest or something that's, it's just not so interesting.
And so tell us a little bit about some of the publishers that you really look to for children's books at the moment.
So I really love Pushkin Press. They publish for adults as well, but they also have a children's imprint, and they've reissued lots of European classics. So the one that I think is probably best is called Letter to the King, which is an old Dutch classic. The author is Tonke Drecht. It's almost like The Hobbit, but the Dutch Hobbit. And they translated it here, and we've just sold hundreds of copies because it's such a wonderful story about a journey that a young 16-year-old boy takes across a kingdom. And it's his job to save the kingdom. I think children really identify with a child coming out best in a story.
How well do they translate?
Translation is a difficult sort of area in lots of things. In children's books, I think it's a matter of making sure that it's a simple story, and children will enjoy the story more so than the words. But I find that with most translations, they're great. I mean, with Letter to the King, you wouldn't necessarily know that the book had been translated unless someone told you, because it's so well written and so well done. So I think only certain publishers can do it well, because you have to take the time and the effort, and to understand that children's books need as much effort as a book for an adult, if not more, because you have to keep them engaged. And it's also the most sort of integral moment to catch a child and make sure that they love reading forever.
And do you find that there are themes within stories that are particularly popular?
Usually it involves a child being left alone. One of our bestsellers at the moment is a book called The Mixed Up Files of Miss Basil E. Frankweiler, and that's an old American book about two children who run away and decide to live at the Met in New York, and they live in the art gallery, and they make their money from stealing pennies from the fountains, and they sleep in the exhibitions. And I think children like that possibility of being left alone without their parents and to have their own adventure, and that's what really appeals.
And how much are you looking at things like illustration as well?
Any book that also has illustrations for children is always, I think, they're much better, not only because they keep the child more engaged, but the parents like them because they can then use those if they want to read them as bedtime stories. And I just think children can be intimidated by a full page of text, and if you have illustrations within the text like David Walliams does, then that really appeals to young children because it's not quite as intimidating when they look at it on the page.
And do you find that there are particular illustrators that work well with particular authors?
So someone like Oliver Jeffers, who does his own children's picture books but will then also work with writers for older children, so David Almond or John Boyne, and illustrate their books so they engage. I think the most classic pairing is obviously Roald Dahl and Quentin Blake, and it's always worked so well that authors often will have a collaboration with an illustrator because it means that children will identify their books.
When your customers come in, what sort of things are they asking about children's books? What do they want to have recommended?
They want to have recommended something that they've not heard of before. Often, particularly with our customers, I have children that seem to have read every book under the sun. So you're constantly having to stay two or three steps ahead to make sure that you're reading things that they may not have heard of. And it's difficult because when you're reading books for children, you have to look at it through a child's eye. And things that we may find really engaging, a child may not understand, or they might find dull. So you have to sort of constantly sort of tread a line between the two. But our customers mostly are looking for new, interesting, very well written or beautifully presented. I think they just want the most beautiful things. And there's so many children's books that are produced, and you get the impression that the publisher may not have taken the time that it deserves, that when we find stuff that publishers have done a really good job on, we want to sort of shout about those.
Children's books are quite often quite tactile things as well. Is there much move from children's publishing online at all?
There is within the teen market particularly, as obviously the teenage generation that growing up now is so technologically literate. But we're lucky in that children's books, particularly younger children's books, parents want to make sure that their children have physical books and understand the importance of physical books. So I think where there has been movement perhaps in fiction, adult fiction, children's fiction has stayed much more stable because parents want them to have books. Even though I said that within teen books a lot of that has gone online and to ebooks, equally there are still huge numbers of authors coming through in YA fiction, which is having a real resurgence. And it's nice to see that children and teenagers particularly are reading more and more. And it's nice that a market has developed to sort of serve them too.
And I guess with young adult fiction, sometimes it crosses over into the adult market a little bit too. Do you get many adults coming in wanting to read those books too?
Definitely. I mean, obviously, I think that began with something like Twilight, but within the YA market, there's lots of books that are read by adults as well. Someone like Patrick Ness, who writes really well, I mean, are perfectly readable for adults as well as teenagers. And also, I mean, I think lots of people enjoy the lack of pretension within a teen book, that they can read it and enjoy it and they don't necessarily have to get bogged down in too much meaning. But equally, there are books that are written like The Knife of Never Letting Go, which is a really complex world and is putting lots of sort of moral arguments out. And so in a way, I think it's actually the teen fiction has become more intelligent as opposed to people have dumbed down.
And you say that there's a nostalgia for the older stories at the moment. Where do you see children's publishing going in the next couple of years?
I think that, as we've seen in the past year or so, that there is a market for very beautifully illustrated big books. So we've done very well with things like Maps and Animalium and Historium, which are big, beautiful books. So I think it'll probably move more towards that and have sort of gifty books, kind of a split between beautiful gifty books for presents and for Christmas and birthdays, and then also a real growth in fiction
finally, what was your favourite children's book when you were a child and what did you love about it?
My favourite children's book was Matilda by Roald Dahl, and I think something caught my imagination in the fact that she read every book in the library, and that's probably why I'm still a bookseller.
That was Yonah Dudley, bookseller at Daunt Books here in London. South Korean film, television dramas and music have all gained a following in East Asia and beyond. But outside of the country, not much is known about its folklore. Canadian author Mark Russell introduces us to some of Korea's legends in his new book, Young Hee and the Palocho. Monocle correspondent Jason Strother recently sat down with him at his home in Seoul to talk about writing Korean children's fiction from an outsider's perspective.
Mark Russell has spent much of the past 20 years in South Korea. He got his start here by writing about the country's popular culture for The Hollywood Reporter and has authored two books on the subject. Young Hee and the Palocho is his first work of fiction. It's a fantasy about a girl who discovers a magic doorway that leads her into a world full of Korean folklore and mythical creatures. Mark invited me into his home in one of Seoul's high-rise apartment towers to talk about the book.
All new for me as well. He's 13 months and so now...
His 13-month-old son, James, didn't want to leave his dad alone with some stranger wielding a microphone, so he sat in on our chat.
I love portal fantasy type stories. They're not very trendy or sexy in the science fiction community these days, but, you know, one of the first books, memories I have is my father reading the Narnia books to my sister and I when we were young. It's a really kind of a universal idea of usually a young woman, not always, but a young, you know, a girl on the cusp of adolescence with all these troubles and stresses in her home life and goes to a magical world where she can kind of work on those issues metaphorically. I've just seen it over and over again in different places of the world, and I hadn't found that story in Korea. Maybe it exists, but I had never discovered it, so I kind of wanted to tell it myself.
What is up? Palocho.
Palocho is kind of a magic root, like a ginseng, supposed to have a lot of powers. Depending on the story, you know, some people think it gives immortality. It turns up in folklore in different ways over the years, and you can see it in traditional paintings. So, yeah, just a powerful traditional root of some sort.
What made you want to make the switch from writing about Korean popular culture to writing a children's book based on Korean folklore?
Well, a lot of my journalism was about media and entertainment, especially, you know, in movies. So I was going, I saw a lot of Korean films, watched a lot of Korean TV dramas, and I began to notice often they would use as reference points or starting off points things that they had seen in Hollywood films or in foreign TV dramas that didn't really seem true to me, to the Korean experience. So I started kind of just working in the back of my head the idea of what would a Korean story be that, I mean, I don't want to say more authentic. Obviously, Koreans are authentically Korean. They can tell their own stories. But it was something that, just as an outsider, I think sometimes I notice things that are different than what an insider sees. It's true anywhere. So I started thinking about a story that would be true to the Korea that I see.
Are there any defining elements in Korean children's stories that differ, let's say, from the stories that kids would read back home in the West?
One thing about Korea I've noticed in general is it tends to very freely mix and match cultural elements. So when you look at Korean traditional stories, there are, you know, you can see Japanese elements with certain creatures, you can see Chinese elements, Buddhism, you know, brings over things. Since the Western missionaries started coming in the 19th century, you can see European folklore tropes and ideas turning up. And sometimes a Korean story will get pushed towards like a Cinderella version or, you know, because folktales always morphing and changing depending on who's telling it and why they're telling it. So you can often see these European folklore elements turning up that probably weren't there 200 years ago. To me, good children's books aren't very didactic or condescending. You know, little Timmy, little Susie doesn't need to be told that stealing's bad or whatever. That's not how we learn things. It's just the process of having a fun, engaging story that's well told. The lessons from it are implicit, and the the fun part of a book is just reading a fun book. So that's what I was trying to do. And if people enjoy it of whatever age, I'm very happy.
During our interview here, your son James has been patiently sitting on your lap. I know you started work on the book before he was born. How did expecting to be a father and being a father influence your work or your interest in writing this children's story?
This is probably a bad answer for an interview situation like this, but it had really no influence at all. I started writing this book in 2012 when living in Spain, and there was no plans for a baby at all at the time. So, yeah, it's... James came along during the tail end of the rewrite for the publisher, for Tuttle Books. It's been fun to see, you know, because there's some younger characters in the book, and so it's fun to see him slowly taking on some of the characteristics of the things I describe, but it wasn't my plan at all originally.
For Monocle and Soul, I'm Jason Strother.
Thanks, Jason. After the break, we'll go to the studio of illustrator Vivienne Schwartz, and one of Monocle's own will be waxing lyrical about her favourite children's book.
Monocle loves books. We love them so much that we have our very own books team in partnership with our friends at Gestalten in Berlin. We've already launched the muscular and handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living and the Monocle Guide to Good Business too, plus the London, New York, Hong Kong and Tokyo titles in our new hardback City Guide series. And now there's a giant Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes that's packed with inspiring residences and practical advice for making your ideal and welcoming residence. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. See our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com and on the shelves of all great bookstores.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and today we're delving into the world of children's publishing. They say pictures can paint 1,000 words, and this is particularly true in books for young children, where words are often sparse, but the pages are rich with bright illustrations. Vivienne Schwartz is a German illustrator based in London, whose picture books aim to encourage creativity among their readers. She's written and drawn several publications, including a graphic novel, and much of her work has been nominated for various illustration awards. Producer Holly headed to Vivienne's studio on a leafy street in southeast London to learn more about her work and her new book, which was fresh from the printers, called How to Find Gold.
"Let's find gold," said Anna. "That would be dangerous and difficult," said Crocodile. "Good," said Anna. "Let's go."
"Wait, finding gold takes planning," said Crocodile.
"It does." Most of my books are interactive, quite obviously with flaps, or a lot of them are. I think all of them are interactive. All books are interactive anyway, because you interact with them, but sometimes you notice that more. And I'm quite aware that a book is basically like a theatre, like a stage with actors in it. And picture books are particularly performative because they're usually read out by someone to a child. So there is an audience, there is an actual voice, there is a script. There are puppets, there are scene changes when you turn the pages. It's really interesting to think, and useful to think, of a picture book as a theatre, as a stage.
You work with children as well, you do art classes for them. Do you find that working with them inspires other books that you want to make?
Yes, I think I'm noticing that it's getting easier to put things in my books, like things to make and do, and to make things that encourage children to make things or to do things. Encouragement is the main thing I'm aiming for with all of my books. And the more I'm working with children, the more workshops I'm running, the more I'm thinking about what the perfect art school would be, what the perfect encouragement would be, the easier I find to do that in the books. It's basically feeding back and forth. I've done one book that's all actually about how to set up your own workshop at home, which is called Welcome to Your Awesome Robot. It starts basically with nothing, and in the end you've got the whole neighbourhood in the house with some rules about how to not set everything on fire. I hope it makes families actually work together and make things.
What do you have to think about in terms of maybe putting morals and lessons into your stories?
I don't do that. I have some principles that I believe in, like I think kindness is very important, but I don't make stories that have a moral that say, oh, someone wasn't kind and it went badly and then they were kind and they get rewarded. I just incorporate things, such principles into the stories, but actually the first thing is to tell a story to encourage. I care more about it that, for example, in the cat books, the cats talk to the children directly, and you look through the books and it isn't really a moral, obviously, but actually the kids are asked to help the cats. The cats talk to them very politely, and so they're respected, and so the children learn that they're respected, that they're important, that they can do something, that they can make a friend, and I find that more important.
What do you think makes a good children's book?
There are lots of ways. It's basically, it depends on what you want from it. A good non-fiction book is something that makes you, that satisfies your curiosity and makes you even more curious at the same time. A good picture book might be one that really entertains you, where you remember it forever as this thing that you shared with your parents, or that you read by yourself and it changed your world somehow, or a book that makes you do something that you're proud of. Or it could be a book that you really hated, that was awful, but made you think, and you realise that you have an opinion, and maybe you told someone how much you hated that book, and they said, show me that, and looked at it and said, yes, you're right, it's awful. And you realise that you're an important person. That's also good. Kids need something to complain about as well. Hang on. Gold is very heavy. We might not be strong enough to carry it, said Crocodile. Is it heavier than a crocodile? Probably not, said Crocodile. I am strong enough, then she says, lifting up the crocodile, as you can see in this picture.
You have a book coming out next year called How to Find Gold. Do you want to just talk us a little bit through the illustration in this?
When the book starts out, the whole world is basically just, it's just grey pencil drawings, fairly realistic. That's the real world. And you get these two characters, Anna and Crocodile, who are best friends. And they go off to find gold. I think quite clear that in some way they are creating this world that they go into with their imagination. The challenge was to draw that world so that you can still see, so you understand it, but that it is drawn from the mind of a 4-year-old girl and her crocodile friend. Crocodile can't technically draw very well. The crocodile draws even scrawlier. And their kind of reference points are a bit small, so they do go to an exotic island at some point. But when you look at the actual trees they've scribbled, you can see that it's actually stuff that might grow in some London suburb. And that the ship that they make doesn't... It's got everything. It's got a clockwork motor and a sail. It's got a tent on it and some bunting. It's got basically everything. They just make sure that everything is on there, and everything is basically drawn as a child would draw it in all their favourite colours.
And that's quite interesting how you have drawn some parts of the book as if a child had drawn it. Is that to sort of inspire their imagination a little bit?
It's basically to just validate their imagination a bit. I think to kind of... Because it's not quite like they imagine it, maybe. They imagine something awesome, but if they draw it, it would come out like something that Anna and Crocodile do. And that's in a real book. And so I just want them to look at these things and go, wow, I can do that. And that they look at this gold treasure that Anna and Crocodile find, that is basically old scrolls, wonderfully... Well, it took me days to basically... I think I spent a week really badly drawing gold. And I actually went to an exhibition at the National Gallery all about old masters painting gold, and I checked out how they did it so that I could do a 4-year-old's version of that, which was really hard. So it's like really skilled and unskilled at the same time, and very researched but very naive at the same time, just to get exactly the right tone so that a child will look at it and go, I can do that. You know, when they go through galleries and like parents are like, my child could do that. That's exactly what I want from my books. I want the whole family to say, my child could have made this book. Wait, let's make a book. Not all gold is buried. There is also sunken gold, said Crocodile. Let's find that, said Anna. It's even more dangerous and difficult, said Crocodile. Good, said Anna. Let me explain, said Crocodile. It is like this. Crocodile made another drawing.
Wow, said Anna. Is it really like that?
Yes, said Crocodile.
Anna got the boat. Let's find the things on your drawing, she said, and then dive for gold.
That was illustrator Vivienne Schwartz, and you can find out more about her work at vivienneschwartz.co.uk. Her new book, How to Find Gold, is a beautiful piece of work and will be available to buy next year. We're going to end the show with a few thoughts from Monocle's Chiara Rimella. She muses on the role books played in her life as she was growing up in Italy.
When I was young, it was quite hard to understand the value of money, so my parents always described products to me as being worth 1, 2, 3 books, where a book stood for about 10,000 liras, the standard average cost of a book. Alas now, Ascolta il mio cuore retails for €8.50, almost double the amount it would have cost back in the 90s. But there's another purpose that my favourite childhood book can still work as a unit of measurement for. Published in 1991, this novel by Bianca Pizzorno is a hefty 400-ish pager. My copy was a light paperback, which I used to open so wide it looked like the spine was going to split. Belly up, belly down, tossing and turning, I read it for the first time, splayed on my bed in the immobile heat of an Italian summer, where I chose to stay with my book rather than go out and play with my cousin in the alfalfa fields. Sardinian author Pizzorno wrote book upon book where fearless girls would live everyday adventures. Ascolta il mio cuore is the story of Prisca, Elisa and Rosalba, three middle-class kids in post-war Sardinia, angry at the fact their strict, odious teacher won't treat the disprivileged kids in their class in the same way. The way they plot their classroom revenge has something a little bit Roald Dahl about it, and I suppose the book's unmistakably jagged illustrations by Quentin Blake helped draw parallels. But the heart of the story wasn't just a classic tale of being proud of being different from the crowd. It was proper social class conflict. It sounded important and grown up too. This is a book about friendship and justice, things that matter intensely to a 9-year-old. That's why I read it, memorably, in 3 days, and that's why it became a new unit of measurement. A measure of time and enjoyment. A book took me 2 weeks to read. I could have reread Ascolta il mio cuore 4 times instead. Take the book I'm reading right now, for example, The Luminaries by Eleanor Catton. It's over 800 pages, so theoretically only 2 or 3 times as long as Ascolta il mio cuore. But I've been reading it for a good 2 months now. So how many Ascolta il mio cuore is that? For Monocle, in London, I am Chiara Rimella.
Thanks, Chiara. So what makes a good children's book? Well, if we go by our experts, then you need a child narrator, beautiful and bright designs that make the story pop from the page, and interactivity is important too, whether you're lifting the flap to reveal a hidden character or reading aloud in funny accents to bring the story to life. Interacting with a book is how to engage a child's attention. These books work better on the page than on your computer, and it sounds like children's appetite for reading isn't going to diminish anytime soon. There doesn't necessarily need to be a moral to the tale, but the words and pictures need to work together to capture a child's imagination and send it running wild, as what happens on the page is just as important as what's happening off the page. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Piglet-Fisher, to my Winnie the Pooh. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.